Welcome to today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, May 4th. I'm your reader, Wanda, and here is our first story. Professors Switch Quickly to Online Teaching by Danielle Gehr. University of Northern Iowa professor Analia Dimitrova expected the coronavirus would cause a two-week spring break extension, not a swift end to campus life and the beginning of teaching online. She thought it was odd, she said, when one of her students noted in March that their last class before spring break could be their last meeting in person. Very quickly, it became apparent that that was very naive and idealistic. Dimitrova, who teaches journalism and ethics, said, "The first case of COVID-19 appeared on March 8th in Iowa, and the number of cases continues to rise despite statewide closures of schools, restaurants, churches, stores, and other businesses. Universities will finish semesters online, graduation ceremonies are canceled or going virtual, and summer plans are uncertain." More than a month later, Iowa college instructors like Dimitrova are learning how to deliver a world-class education from behind a computer screen while also navigating working from home. Changes in coursework and uncertainty on what comes after this shift in teaching. Iowa State professor and Faculty Senate President Jonathan Sturm said ISU faculty switched to distance learning quickly in March 2020. "There'll be some changes, you know, some faculty will have to decrease their expectations. Things may happen a little more slowly." A snapshot. The changes affect 66,000 faculty members at Iowa's public universities, 3,421 at the University of Iowa, 1,910 at Iowa State, and 697 at Northern Iowa. At UNI, 300 laptops were checked out so students would have technology to finish classes, meaning that not all teachers and students may be able to participate. One professor said she spends 4 hours straight teaching online two-hour courses. Others said grading time doubled or tripled. The end date for online instruction is unclear. Iowa State and University of Iowa announced summer courses will proceed online. There's also the question of the effectiveness of online learning. Distance learning was a growing part of university culture long before the pandemic. Students participating in at least one online course in fall 2015 made up 27.9% of all high education enrollment nationally, according to a 2017 Digital Learning Compass survey. The survey found 41.8% of Iowa's undergraduate and graduate students, or nearly 115,000 students, enrolled in at least one distance learning course that year. At the three public universities, over 37,000 students participated in at least one online class in fall 2018. From 2014 to 2018, Regents institutions saw a 46.5% increase in online programs. The technology existed beforehand, but many professors never taught an online class until COVID-19. President of ISU's Faculty Senate, Jonathan Sturm, who teaches music history, said he avoided working with some technologies because he thought they didn't add to his course. "Now the software is necessary," he felt behind the curve. His first quiz accidentally gave away an answer to the students, Sturm said. His wife, Julie Sturm, an Iowa State professor of music theory, takes extra steps when grading assignments set as a PDF since the formal format isn't compatible with her computer software. What seems like minor technical issues have multiplied Julie Sturm's daily workload threefold, sometimes extending her grading process to 15 hours a day, her husband said. Past studies on distance learning's effectiveness show mixed results. A 2015 Wright State University study found the grades of online learners to be higher, contradicting several past studies. On the other hand, a 2017 Brookings Institution study found online students do substantially worse in future courses compared to in-person class students. Online education may contribute to the social, economic, and racial achievement gaps, according to a George Mason University study in 2019. Many professors experiencing online learning during the pandemic say it will never fully replace the traditional class setting. Though the 2017 study ended with negative results for online learning, the researchers concluded online learning's flexibility and affordability serve a purpose in higher education. With this technology, students will still earn degrees even during a pandemic. A century ago, the opportunity to learn halted for many during the Spanish flu. During that pandemic, which killed an estimated 657,000 Americans, schools closed for weeks without the option for distance learning. Iowa State Faculty Senate Resolution 1919 states while students must take responsibility for their own education, faculty must ensure, despite many new challenges posed by COVID-19, a world-class education is still available. National news outlets reported universities are preparing to potentially continue the online model into 2021. Dmitrov said lasting effects could come. The benefits of flexibility, cost effectiveness, and reduced environment impact could lead to more work from home in and outside of higher education post-coronavirus. I think the pandemic is shifting the paradigm. I think maybe conducting these classes online in media or some mixture of online moving forward would better prepare students for a workplace, she said. I'm sure many employers would prefer to have people work from home. Adapting some classes to online is easier than others. STEM classes move from hands-on lab time to online simulation software. Technical difficulties stunt discussion-heavy courses. Iowa State Associate Teaching Professor Diane Bugaja said the hands-on courses like her photojournalism course is not as effective from being behind a screen. Even her final project, a slideshow of 25 of their best photos on any given topic, with an audio interview playing over the top, would not be feasible. With directions from medical professionals to remain 6 feet apart, preferably more, Bugaja knew she could not ask her students to stick a microphone in front of someone's face. Instead, students will be using their virtual eye to capture their experiences in isolation. I think there's going to be a lot of different stories. I think that we all assume that we're all cooped up in our house and we're all going to be the same. I don't think so, she said. This kind of worked out one way. I think it's really important that students go to this place that they need to go to sort out this experience. Some essential workers helping maintain basic services as people spend more time at home. By Andrew Wind. While many are isolated at home to slow the spread of COVID-19, others continue venturing out in order to meet essential needs as part of their jobs. That includes workers in all aspects of food production and service, medical staff, and emergency personnel. those who help provide basic services to people spending more time in their homes are also part of the essential workforce. Kevin Tietmeyer collects garbage, yard waste, and recycling for the Cedar Falls Public Works Department. He is one of four maintenance workers who drive routes and perform other related duties. He said workers are doing more cleaning and disinfecting than usual, but otherwise the routine hasn't changed a lot. Each truck has a disinfectant spray that's used on the vehicles at least twice a day. Workers also have gloves and safety glasses to wear when handling garbage. The way workers always do the routes fits in well with social distancing recommendations. With a mechanical arm that picks up and dumps garbage into the truck, most routes include only one person. Most of all, it's automated, said Tietmeyer. Drivers never need to get out. Still, he said, garbage collectors are getting greater acknowledgement of their work from the community with more people at home. You're starting to see people out waving at you and talking to you, said Tietmeyer, sometimes to tell them they're doing a good job. I think a lot of people haven't seen the truck operate. It's a big fascination to see something different. He added, we can tell that people are home now because there's more garbage than there is normally. It feels like we're back into the summer mode because the kids are all home. Tietmeyer offered some tips to make sure garbage collectors can do their job as efficiently as possible. Cedar Falls residents should put out the trash by 7 a.m. on collection day. Recycling and garbage bins should always be 3 to 4 feet away from any other object, including each other. Take trash or garbage bags that don't fit in the bin to the transfer station where it can be disposed of for a fee. Workers at the Cedar Falls Wastewater Treatment Plant also have an essential job to do. Mike Nyman, manager of the facility, said his staff maintains the sanitary sewer system. That includes several mains and pump stations throughout the city, as well as the treatment plant itself. They also do maintenance on storm water pipes across Cedar Falls. We just make sure the sanitary sewer keeps flowing, keeps moving along, he said. It's constant maintenance and just making sure the water gets to the treatment plant instead of back up in the city. There's an effort to minimize staffing during the pandemic, where people are advised to be out in public as little as possible. A fourth of our staff is off at any one time, Nyman explained, of the 12-person workforce, with some staggering of shifts during the day. They're working 2 weeks and having 12 days off. The city is paying them to stay home, safe, isolate a little bit. He noted that we have to staff the facility and we have to maintain the lift stations, but workers are operating as independently as possible while doing the job. Some tasks do require two people, though. There are situations where those who were off would need to come in, such as dealing with the aftermath of a big rainstorm that causes flooding issues. And whatever the cause, workers are still responding to sewer backup problems that sometimes occur in neighborhoods. There's also a couple of us who can work from home, noted Nyman. We're alternating working from home and working from the office. Once concerns of spreading the coronavirus have passed, he acknowledged that the division will have a backlog of work to catch up on. We're doing the minimum and maintaining everything, he said, Nyman. Black Hawk County Supervisor Chris Schwartz seeks second term by Tim Jamieson. The chairman of the Black Hawk County Board of Supervisors will be seeking re-election. Chris Schwartz, 40, of 214 Highland Boulevard, Waterloo, has formally announced his candidacy for one of three seats up for grabs this year. He is one of five Democrats seeking nomination in the June 2nd primary for a spot on the November general election ballot. In my first term in office, I have won victories to protect unions, treat employees fairly, open a homeless warming center, open a veterans center, protect water quality, expand public health services, repair our bike trails, expand conservation lands, improve public parks, increase flood resiliency, enhance renewable energy, welcome immigrants to our community, increase access to mental health services, upgrade our infrastructure, and improve public safety, he said. Schwartz noted he has attended every board meeting and every town meeting organized by departments since he was elected in 2016. I will always be a supervisor for the people and will be a voice for those who have none, he said. Whether you are talking about the homeless, the mentally ill, scared workers, or veterans, I am going to be their advocate no matter how powerful the forces are that we are up against. This type of leadership is more important now than ever before. Schwartz said he has worked to make county government more transparent and accessible, creating the first official Facebook page for the county and working to make videos of all meetings available on Facebook and YouTube. He has been holding weekly fireside chats on his Facebook page during the COVID-19 pandemic. I got a lot done in my first term as your county supervisor, from the creation of a new veterans center, the establishment of a homeless warming center, to investments in green energy, watershed management, and expanded mental health services in our jail. He said, I know with me, you can trust that I will show up at each and every day ready to be a voice for the people. Schwartz serves on boards on a number of local and statewide nonprofits, including the Middle Cedar River Watershed Management Authority, Blackhawk Creek Soil and Watershed Coalition, Operation Threshold, Cedar Valley Pride Fest, Northeast Iowa Food Bank, Friends of Iowa CASA, Iowa Citizen Action Network, County Alternative Energy Committee, Cedar Valley Crush Coalition on Opioids, and the Northland Area Response Group. He is the current president of the National Association of Counties LGBTQ Leaders and Allies. Schwartz lives in Waterloo with his fiance, Logan Buckley. For more information on his campaign, can be found online at schwartzforsupervisor.com or Facebook at Vote Chris Schwartz. Other Democratic supervisor candidates are Terrence Hollingsworth, Marty Postal, and incumbents Linda Leyland and Tom Little. East High to host live virtual play, 10 Ways to Survive Quarantine by Kristen Guess. With canceled classes and social distancing orders, East High students have gotten creative for their spring play. Instructor Joseph Frenna had his second play planned for the school's spring semester when the coronavirus pandemic hit. Frenna's passion for theater ensued the show Will Go On. 10 Ways to Survive Life in Quarantine will air on the school's East High Drama Facebook page at 7 p.m. May 15th and 16th. From rehearsal to showtime, students will remain in the comfort of their home, collaborating with each other over the internet. Background sets, costumes, and props are all up to the students to decorate and design. If there's one thing theater kids know how to do, it's adapt, said Ami Roquette, a freshman who has two parts in the play. Roquette said all the extra time has allowed her plenty of opportunities to practice for her roles. She said the cast and crew of about 30 students have worked well together. It's like a family almost, she said. Frenna, a University of Northern Iowa graduate, said it's important for students to continue to express themselves during times of uncertainty. Our kids are losing so much right now. I didn't want them to lose this too, he said. Frenna's student taught at East while studying at UNI before landing teaching jobs at NU, Denver, and Cedar Falls High School. This is his second year as a full-time instructor at East. I fell in love with it. I always had a sense that I'd wind out of back here. It's really been great, he said. I have never experienced a student body with so much talent. One arrested an overnight shooting by Jeff Reinitz. A Waterloo man has been arrested for allegedly shooting at a house early Sunday. Police arrested Trenton J. Sliker, S-L-I-E-K-E-R-S, 27 of 1311 Forest Avenue, for intimidating with a weapon, felon in possession of a firearm, possession of burglary tools, carrying weapons, possession of marijuana, and driving while suspended. According to police, residents called to report 6 or 7 gunshots and a person driving away on a motorcycle around 12:15 a.m. Sunday, and officers found a bullet had struck the front door of 212 West 10th Street. No one was injured. Police found a motorcycle a short distance away, and Slikers was found on the porch of 1401 Commercial Street. Officers discovered a .38 caliber revolver in a mailbox near Slikers, according to police. Police also found a set of lockpicks. Independence cancels Independence Day plans by Jeff Reinitz. The city, known of its Independence Day celebrations, won't be celebrating this year. What would have been the 160th annual 4th of July parade in Independence has been canceled, along with the Celebration Indy, which would have been in its 19th year. The culprit is the coronavirus, which has felled countless other celebrations this year. Never did we expect this event to be canceled due to a global health pandemic, COVID-19, organizers with the Independence Area Chamber of Commerce and the festival said in a prepared statement. To do our best part in preventing the spread of COVID-19, along with current recommendations, the Celebrate Indy Committee and Independence Area Chamber of Commerce cannot, in good faith, gather thousands of our friends, family members, and neighbors over July 3rd and 4th and risk what we have all been working so hard for over the past 2 months, the statement continued. To help offset the cost of prepaid expenses that Celebrate Indy has incurred, Celebrate Indy will host a t-shirt sale and is also accepting donations at celebrateindy.com. House GOP leader endorses Miller Meeks in 2nd District primary. State Senator Marionette Miller Meeks' bid for the Republican nomination in Iowa's 2nd District has been endorsed by the party's leader in the U.S. House. California Representative Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, has endorsed Miller Meeks as someone who represents the goals, interests, and aspirations of the people of the 24-county district that includes Johnson, Muscatine, and Scott counties. Her hard work and dedication to service are needed more than ever to flip this Democrat-led seat for the people, McCarthy said. Candidates like Marionette will help us regain control of the people's house and give President Donald Trump a Congress that works with him each day rather than obstructs his every move to strengthen our economy, secure our borders, and make health care more affordable and accessible to working families. His endorsement speaks volumes about the importance of the 2nd District in Republicans' efforts to regain the House majority, Miller Meeks said. He knows, "I'll never quit fighting for conservative principles, and I'll never give up on the people of Iowa," she said. His support is a clear message to Iowa and the rest of the country that the people of the 2nd District have an extraordinary opportunity to reshape our country's future by standing with me on June 2nd and again in November. Miller Meeks is an Army veteran and an ophthalmologist, is in a 5-way race for the GOP nomination. The other candidates are Tim Broschert of Iowa City, Stephen Early of Knoxville, Rick Phillips of Pella, and Bobby Schilling of LeClaire. The winner will face Democrat Rita Hart of Wheatland, a former state senator. The winner will claim the 2nd District held by Democratic Representative Dave Lovsek, who is not seeking re-election. The 2nd District is rated as a toss-up, according to national political forecasters. It's the country's only open Democratic-held district that President Donald Trump carried in 2016. A recent Des Moines Register Iowa poll showed a generic Republican leading a generic Democrat by 8% in the district. You are listening to the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Norma Jean Klein, 91 of Cedar Falls, formerly of Waterloo, died Sunday, May 3rd at New Aldea Lifescapes. She was born August 27, 1928 in Waterloo, daughter of Tom and Betty Murphy McCrane. She was a student of Sacred Heart High School. She married James Jim Klein on June 18, 1951 in Waterloo. He died January 11, 1986. Jean was employed by Stewart's Women's Clothing Store, later Jean Nicole, for 23 years, retiring in 2000. She was a member of Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church, Waterloo. She's survived by 3 daughters, Diane Stoffergen, husband Tony Anderson of Waterloo, Mary Beth, husband Max Kirk of Cedar Falls, and Karen, husband Mike Jones of Waterloo. 5 grandchildren, 14 great-grandchildren, 2 great-great-grandchildren, and a sister, Patricia Anders of Cedar Falls. She is preceded in death by her parents, her husband, a sister, Betty Winninger, a son-in-law, Bill Stoffergen, and brother-in-law, Larry Winninger and Chuck Anders. Services, a memorial mass, will be held at a later date at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church. Private family graveside services will be held in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Kearns Funeral Service, Kimball Chapel, Waterloo, is in charge of arraignments. 319-233-3146. Memorials, in lieu of flowers, memorials to Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church, 650 Stephen Avenue, Waterloo, Iowa, 50701, or New Aldea Lifescapes, 7511 University Avenue, Cedar Falls, Iowa, 50613. Cards sent to the funeral home will be forwarded to the family. Online condolences at www.kernsfuneralservice.com. A stranger to her is just a friend she hasn't met yet. Gladys May Reddick, 87, of Tripola, died Wednesday, April 29th at Bartles Lutheran Retirement Community in Waverly. She was born January 18, 1933, on a farm near Tripola, daughter of Harold and Edna Meyer Kunth. Gladys graduated from Tripola High School in 1951. On August 5, 1951, she married Gerhard R. Reddick at Grace Lutheran Church, Tripola. Gladys worked with her husband for more than 40 years at Reddick Funeral Home and Reddick Furniture Store, both in Tripola. She was a member of Grace Lutheran Church. She chaired the Tripola Days Committee for many years. She helped start the Christmas Around Tripola celebration, was a member of the Christmas Boutique Committee, and the Tripola Commercial Club. Gladys had led an aqua-sized class at the indoor pool, was a member of the American Legion Auxiliary and the Red Hat Society. In her retirement years, she worked at the Tripola Library. Her survivors are her children, Dr. Richard, wife Anita Reddick of Tripola, and Joan, Dr. Bill Hickley of Reddick of Madison, Wisconsin. Two grandsons, Dr. Garrett, wife Denise Reddick of Coralville, and their children, Reese, Tate, and Trey, and Taylor, a wife, Jessica Reddick of Cedar Falls, and their children, Roman, Jovi, and Cal. A sister, Alice, husband, Mel Olson of Oshkosh, Wisconsin. A sister-in-law, Rochelle Quinthe of Tripola, and several nieces, nephews, and cousins. She's preceded in death by her parents, her husband, Gerhard, on January 15, 2005. A brother, Wendell, a sister, Donna, husband, Leo Sauerbrei, and a nephew, John Martin. Private family graveside services will be held at Grace Lutheran Church. There will be a private family viewing at Reddick Funeral Home in Tripola. Join the family at 2:15 p.m. Monday, May 4th, via Facebook Live on Becker, Milnes, and Reddick Facebook page. A celebration of life services will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials to Grace Lutheran Church in Tripola, Tripola Schools Fine Arts or Athletic Boosters, Tripola Pool, or Tripola Library. Online condolences at www.beckermilnesreddick.com. Gladys was an avid golfer and enjoyed ice skating, bowling, and cross-country skiing. She was a wonderful cook and loved to entertain, and no meal was complete without a tasty dessert. Gladys was a very loving, compassionate person. A smile and kind words were her gifts to everyone. Sports, John Romano of the Tampa Bay Times. When will the longest day in American sports history finally end? The leaders of the nation's largest sports leagues began April on a conference call with President Donald Trump and finished a month on another call with the White House's medical experts. Officially, the question is whether to play or not to play. Realistically, the question is whether to be bold or lay low. When it comes to restarting society in the shadow of a pandemic, safety is obviously the greatest concern. When it comes to the sports world, another consideration is almost as powerful and vexing. What level of risk and wrath are owners willing to incur to play a game? President Donald Trump has had a sooner-than-later perspective on restarting the sports calendar, but league commissioners seem cognizant of the potential health backlash if they act too quickly. This is why they've been moving forward with baby steps. This is why so many ideas have been floated anonymously. Before testing the temperature of a single athlete, they appear intent on taking the temperature of a nation. In a move that could be described as either compassionate or shrewd, the four major leagues, MLB, the NFL, the NHL, and the NBA, have avoided specific timetables while letting other sports test the waters first. So, NASCAR, with its minimal contact between competitors, announced this week it would begin racing again in Darlington, South Carolina, on May 17th, with no one in the bleachers. The PGA Tour also is planning spectator-less events beginning June 11th in Fort Worth, Texas. Make no mistake, there is money to be made even without fans in stadiums and arenas. The NFL draft proved that with television ratings on ESPN that were 16% higher than the year before. Horse racing also has stayed afloat the past 2 months without spectators by getting a small cut of online wagering and internet pay-per-view. While TV revenue will not come close to replacing the money lost due to postponement and cancellation in hockey, basketball, and baseball, it could stave off economic disaster while keeping fans tethered to their teams. How will it all work out once sports leaders decide it is acceptable to resume? First of all, there is no talk of fans returning anytime soon. Beyond that, there will be a sliding scale of normalcy depending on the sport and the level of physical contact. Hockey and basketball were nearing their postseason and thus are in the biggest rush to get back into action. That means they likely will have to make the largest adjustments. The NHL seems prepared to limit games, at least initially, to four hubs representing each division. The league could have 20 days or so for training camp, 2 weeks to finish a shortened regular season, all within divisions to limit travel, then a postseason that may stretch into September or beyond, depending on whether they begin gearing up in late May or early June. The league seems willing to delay the start of the 2020-2021 season to get this season completed. Part of the calculation is the longer they delayed next season, the more likely they'll be able to have fans in arenas on opening night. Baseball is not quite so rushed and may attempt to replicate a normal season with half the number of games. Teams likely to play in their own stadiums with schedules that will emphasize limited travel. For cities that have been virus hotspots, such as New York and Seattle, teams may begin the regular season at their spring training stadiums in Florida and Arizona. Like the NHL, baseball seems willing to extend the postseason calendar, with the possibility of having a neutral site World Series in a domed stadium. And no, Tropicana Field probably wouldn't be a major contender if baseball goes this route. The league prefers to showcase new stadiums, which would make Texas a strong possibility. The NFL is likely to be the least affected, provided any second wave of the coronavirus is contained. The Sports Business Journal reported that the NFL is considering contingency dates for Super Bowl 55, scheduled to be played February 7th in Tampa, and that seems logical. But the NFL is not likely to go too far down that road until figuring out the probability of starting the regular season on time in September. If the schedule is not released as expected by May 9th, it may be the first indication that contingency plans will be necessary. Is it all worth it? Certainly not. If virus testing is not widely available or hospitals are straining to meet demand. But if the curve continues to flatten around the country, you can probably expect announcements about training camps and schedules to begin trickling out this month. For a sports fan, the longest day of the year is typically the one after baseball's All-Star game. It is the one day on the calendar that the four major sports, as well as college sports, are all silent. In 2020, the longest day began March 12th. As we move into May, we still await its end. Olympians cope by inspiring others. Online by Jay Cohen. When Jesse Smith looks out at his Zoom audience, he knows exactly what the crowd is going through. The captain of the U.S. men's water polo team is adjusting his training too. He also misses playing alongside his friends. One way Smith is dealing with the coronavirus pandemic is through virtual speaking engagements with water polo clubs and teams all over the country, passing along what he has learned during a couple of decades in the water. The 37-year-old Smith is one of several Olympic athletes who have been using digital avenues to help their sport during the shutdown. While Zoom sessions are a frequent choice, some athletes are offering training tips on Instagram, and Olympic federations are pitching in with newsletters and other web-based help. "We're all, as athletes, affected the same way," Smith said. "Even though I'm a four-time Olympian, a silver medal winner, training for my fifth Olympics, the captain of my team, the same thing is going on in my head as a 16-year-old that's got their season canceled. I think that I have more tools available, so I'm trying to share them." Beach volleyball star Carrie Walsh Jennings has been doing online talks with young volleyball players, including one with a team at her alma mater of Archbishop Mitty High School in California. U.S. wrestlers Mallory Velt, Pat Smith, and Yanni DeCamacasis detailed their at-home workouts in a post on the Federation website. Casey Patterson and April Ross were among a group of beach volleyball players who shared workout tips during Facebook Live sessions on the AV page. The Federation also is reaching out. USA Water Polo has been sending out a weekly newsletter called At Home with USA Water Polo, featuring interviews with coaches and athletes. US Rowing has been holding webinars for its members. USA Volleyball has a page on its website with COVID-19 related resources. A lot of people look to us in the athlete world, in our communities, for us to kind of be a voice. Like, how are we going to respond? What actions are we taking? Said U.S. softball pitcher Monica Abbott, who has been doing speaking engagements with young softball players and holding pitching-inspired workout sessions. The effort by Olympic athletes and Federation comes amid concerns about the future of college sports. Some Olympic sports could be on the chopping block for athletic departments looking to save money after losing revenue due to COVID-19 shutdown. "I wouldn't say that that is something I'm focusing on, but it's definitely something that's in my mind and helps me plan for these," U.S. Water Polo Center Matt Farmer said, "because I'm taking an optimistic view of what's going to happen in college water polo, because it means so much to so many people." Farmer, a 24-year-old Chicago native who played on three NCAA championship teams at UCLA, is focusing his outreach efforts on the Midwest. California is the home of American water polo, but Farmer is hoping he can help some young players follow in his footsteps. I kind of blazed a trail from Chicago to international water polo, Farmer said, and I want to share my experiences with people and maybe give advice to people who are thinking about playing in college or continuing the sport and just want to grow as players and as people. The online conversations usually touch on a variety of topics. There are the usual practical tips for playing the sport at a high level, but there are also elements of sports psychology, especially with young players away from their teams and searching for motivation. Walsh Jennings, a three-time gold medalist, said, "The calls have become a highlight of her day. We're all feeling the same frustrations and longings," she said. "It's pretty special to be able to speak to the fact that we're not alone in this and that it is up to each of us to make the best of what we have to work with, to focus on what we can control." Byron captures his third viral checkered flag. William Bryan Byron showed he's the sharpest gamer in NASCAR's iRacing series with his third victory in four events. Byron passed Timmy Hill with seven laps remaining at Virtual Dover International Speedway, where NASCAR was scheduled to actually race Sunday to win yet again on the iRacing platform. The Hendricks Motorsports driver has consistently been the best of the NASCAR professionals in simulated racing. Alex Bowman won last week at Virtual Talladega Super Speedway, so Hendricks drivers have now won four consecutive iRacing events. "I've enjoyed this iRacing series, but I'm definitely ready to get going in my real car," Byron said. "Racing anything, whether it's a box car or anything with an engine, is going to give you confidence if you are winning." He said that in all his years using iRacing, he's never been in such a competitive events such as NASCAR launched the Invitational Esports Series after the Stock Car Series was suspended March 13th. Denny Hamlin earned the pole in qualifying, but NASCAR successfully applied to an invert. A glitch last week prevented the top 10 from flipping before the race began. So, Ross Chastain cycled into the top starting spot. Hamlin had his race ruined last week when his daughter accidentally turned his simulator screen off with a remote control she was holding as he was competing. He made sure to hide all remotes before Sunday's race. But after an incident with John Hunter Nemechek, he seemed to be deliberately wrecked by Nemechek later in retaliation. It brought out a late caution and restart with nine laps remaining and Hill leading Byron at the green flag. Byron didn't need to use a bump and run, the move Hill used on Byron to win the virtual race at Texas Motor Speedway, and easily passed him on the inside with seven laps remaining. Hill finished second and was shown at times racing with his cat on his steering wheel. Williams has done a great job through this iRacing Invitational, Hill said. "I just wish I could get another win. I've had such tremendous support from everyone in the racing community through this. This has been a blast and really brought us all together. We've really had a lot of fun racing all these races, but I can't wait to get back and see everyone's faces." NASCAR will complete its iRacing series next Saturday at North Carolina's deserted North Wilkesboro Speedway, a track last raced by the National Series in 1996. Overgrown with weeds and clearly neglected, Dale Earnhardt Jr. last year led a group of volunteers in cleaning the speedway so it could be mapped for use in iRacing. Although the simulated version of the North Wilkesboro is not yet available to the public on the iRacing platform, it will be the virtual host of NASCAR's finale. Then it's back to the real thing for the stock cars, which plans to resume competition without spectators starting May 17th at Darlington Raceway in South Carolina. Wall Street opens lower as U.S.-China tensions rise over virus. Stocks are opening lower on Wall Street as tensions worsen between the U.S. and China over the origins and early handling of the coronavirus pandemic. The S&P 500 fell 1% in the first few minutes of trading Monday. Airline stocks took a hit following news over the weekend that billionaire investor Warren Buffett had unloaded his stakes in the four largest U.S. carriers. Retail stocks were also lower after J. Crew became the first major retailer to file for bankruptcy protection during the pandemic. Stocks fell in Europe and overnight in Hong Kong and Taiwan. Trading in mainland China and Japan was closed for holidays. AP's earliest story below is global stock markets dropped on Monday as tensions between the Trump administration and China over the origins and handling of the coronavirus pandemic rattled investors. Benchmarks fell in most countries except for Australia, which was lifted by signs its own virus outbreak is being brought under control. India's Sensex plunged nearly 6% as authorities extended their pandemic-fighting lockdown for another 2 weeks, and new data showed an unprecedented drop in factory activity. In Europe, where markets returned from a long holiday weekend, Germany's DAX dropped 3.5% to 10,480, and the CAC 40 in Paris lost 4% to 4,390. Britain's FTSE 100, which was open on Friday, declined 0.4% to 5,742. The future for the S&P 500 slipped 1.1%, and that for the Dow Industrials lost 0.8%, pointing to a lower open on Wall Street after tech firms brought U.S. markets down at the end of last week. Tokyo, Shanghai, and Bangkok were among markets closed for holiday on Monday. Criticized over his handling of the crisis, President Donald Trump has tried to shift the blame to China. Beijing has repeatedly pushed back on U.S. accusations that the outbreak was China's fault. Antagonism threatened to undo the truce in a trade war between Washington and Beijing that was struck just before China began shutting down much of its economic down in late January to fight the pandemic. The yield on the 10-year Treasury hedged lower to 0.60% from 6.62% on Friday, well below its 1.90% level at the start of the year. Benchmark U.S. crude oil fell 99 cents to $18.79 per barrel in electronic trading on the New York Mercantile Exchange. It gained 94 cents on Friday. U.S. crude has plunged from its perch of roughly $60 at the start of the year on worries about a collapse in demand and strained for storage facilities. Brent crude, the international standard, gave up 60 cents to 25.84 cents per barrel. The dollar fetched 106.81 Japanese yen, down from 106.88 yen on Friday. The euro weakened to $1.03936 from $1.03980. This brings us to the end of today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.